Williams is also at the University of Maryland and with Resources for the Future, and he was recently part of the National Academy study that dealt with energy tax policy and the impact on greenhouse gas emissions. The report is on the outside table if you want to look at it. So the question is simple. Is it the problem is as simple as a price on carbon? Of course, is just the tip of the iceberg of a whole set of issues related to tax policy, environmental impacts, the effect on development of innovation and deployment. And it is a very relevant topic, but not the only topic this committee is going to be interested in, but one that we should start with. And so we will, and I'll turn first to Dallas.
If you want to, and I'm just going to make one quick mention about logistics in terms of format after folks give their presentations. We're going to open the floor first to members of the study committee, and then time permitting, we'll open up again to questions from the audience. Thank you.
I just thought if I stand up here, it's easier to be seen from the back. Thank you very much for inviting me today. I want to talk about, touch on five topics. I want to talk about what we know about the effect of a tax on the electricity sector, then contrast that with cap and trade, contrast that with our research on the effects of regulation, and then talk about the role of institutions and the question of infrastructure and how it gets developed to achieve the kind of technological changes that we might hope for. But first, I want to just give some excerpts from a study that's in prep now by some of my colleagues at Resources for the Future, Anthony Paul and Karen Palmer, on taxing electricity sector carbon emissions at social cost. They've taken the recent update to the social cost of carbon estimates and ran them through our electricity market model, which is sort of like a baby brother to the kinds of things that NEMS or IPM does. It solves out through 2035. And the lessons, there's a really interesting lesson that emerges from this. If you're not familiar with the social cost of carbon study, it identifies a time frame going out into the future for a low, middle, and high case values that are identified from sort of the average of a set of different models that are run, that are integrated assessment models. And then they look at a tail run, which is what if it's not the sort of a expected value consequences that matter with respect to climate change, but rather the unanticipated events and the probabilities of something that might be out at the 95th, well, the consequences of something that might be out at the 95th tail. So they run four, the low, medium, and high runs, and then the tail runs. And the bottom line, which I want to point out, is it's really interesting that each of these touch a different technology at the margin. So with the low run, what we see is an important emergence of energy efficiency and natural gas, virtually doing all of the work in terms of emission reductions that are achieved by putting that modest price on carbon. At the second medium level, there's a new margin that's identified that enters, and that's nuclear power. So you still have important contributions from energy efficiency and natural gas, but nuclear power enters. Now, one reason that renewables don't enter yet, and this is foreshadows what I'm going to talk about in a moment about institutions that are pre-existing, has to do with the role of RPSs, Renewable Portfolio Standards, which now exist in, I think, 30 states. So these essentially are determining the quantity of renewables that are going to penetrate over the next couple decade time horizon, unless something else, at least in those 30 states, which tend to be the states where the greatest renewable resources exist. So unless something happens that was to introduce a price that was so sufficient to overcome the incentives that are already embedded in those renewable policies, then you're not going to get much more renewables. Well, that begins to happen at the high price. So at the high price, then, you get energy efficiency and nuclear grow. There's diminishing contribution from natural gas and, for the first time, the important introduction of renewable technologies. And then in the tail, interestingly enough, what happens is that natural gas diminishes greatly, and the other three technologies are the ones that contribute going forward. So I want to contrast that with what they find under cap and trade. The important difference between the tax approach and cap and trade is that cap and trade allows for banking of emission allowances, and so economists think that the way the price would behave over time in a cap and trade program is that the price would grow at some opportunity cost of capital roughly related to the rate of interest in the economy. This is sort of a hoteling rule that applies. And so those of you who are familiar with that might be able to see then, oh, well, there's a specific time path that's imposed by the economic assumptions of how a market would work with banking. And that time path is going to be different than the social cost of carbon is solved in a different set of models. And so as a consequence, to calibrate this, we said, well, what would cap and trade be to achieve the same emission reductions over a 30-year horizon compared to what were the emission reductions were achieved under the tax? And the consequence is you get a smaller price at the front end, and then that price is growing rapidly over time according to an opportunity cost of capital formula, such that at the back end you get a bigger price than you do from just taking the social cost of carbon estimates per se. And so, as a consequence, you get fewer emission reductions earlier, and then at the end, with a big price change, you get the late introduction of what by then are also more mature technologies, the non-emitting technologies. Which would be better? Well, it depends what you're trying to accomplish, but at the end of the time period, you end up with a price that's higher under this kind of cap-and-trade policy scenario than a tax scenario where the tax is set at the social cost of carbon. And if you think, well, maybe you bring a bias to this question. I think we all do. What do you think we're going to know 25 years from now that's different than what we know now? But if you think, oh, well, we're going to learn that maybe the climate problem is worse, or that it's more desperate that we introduce new technologies or whatever, then you might think that the cap and trade approach with a higher price later is better. If you think that it's really important to get started now, then you're going to, you would prefer the tax approach. Okay, now I want to contrast that with regulation. And regulation, we can represent policies under regulation in a model, but it's not, in my opinion, it's not, modeling is not the right complete set of tools to understand how regulation actually works, because it's really an institutional analysis. And so one can look at historic experience and kind of throw cold water on a conversation that economists usually have. This point is really important to make. As an advocate myself around cap and trade, putting price on externalities, we champion the experience of the SO2 trading program as the historic experience and success story, which indeed from a cost effectiveness perspective, it was. But as we look back now from 2013 back to 1990 and as history gauges the success of the SO2 trading program, it's going to be a mixed bag. And here's why. Because we will, by 2015, 2016, have achieved more reductions in sulfur dioxide emissions from power plants due to regulatory authority under the Clean Air Act since 1990 than we have from the cap and trade program since 1990. And I'm going to characterize that as an unqualified good thing, because from a benefit-cost perspective, the benefits just totally swamp the costs on a ton-per-ton basis of achieving these emission reductions. So for some reason, this beautiful instrument of cap-and-trade let us down. And the reason was that this policy design was unable to adapt to new scientific or cost information, whereas regulation, at least under the Clean Air Act, demonstrates a sort of profound ability to do so. Maybe an aggravating ability sometime, aggravatingly slow, but I like to describe the Clean Air Act as a freight train. It's slow, but hard to stop. And it has built into it natural adaptation mechanisms. So some MIT scholars in 2010, McRae et al., they took a look at 39 regulations across four presidents to find examples of planned adaption, and in these 39 regulations, only six of them had any kind of built-in ability to adapt over time. The best performer among the set was the Clean Air Act, because it required scientific updates, revision of standards, rate of progress requirements, and meeting standards, and then penalties for failing to meet rate of progress. So which invites innovation more among these policies that I've considered so far? Well, first of all, a word on that, and I was really pleased just to shake hands with Jay Apt, because I was going to do a shout out for one of my favorite papers on this study from 6 or 7 years ago that Ed Rubin, Jay Apt, and others at CMU did, looking at what is the engine of innovation in the economy, and that I hope I'm extracting the right lesson from this paper. But the lesson that I choose to extract from the paper is that If you look over a century of technological breakthroughs, the vast majority of those have been due to incremental advances that occurred, either the advances themselves or the application occurred by accident. In other words, it wasn't typically set out that we are going to find a breakthrough to solve this problem, but rather it was sort of an ancillary spin-off that found new applications of incremental improvements in existing technologies. And I think that's interesting when you look at the different types of innovation. I understand from the speaker you heard this morning, there's a question of, well, what, you know, different technologies are different points in the life cycle, and what do they need next? And I think that's really an important thing to keep in mind, that innovation means different things, not to different people, but to different products, because it's where they are on an innovation life cycle that matters. So when I look across these three types of regulatory frameworks, taxes, cap and trade, and regulation, which ignites more innovation, I can think of many more examples from regulation, but this is because it's been tried more often. It's rare that we've tried putting a price on externalities. But in electricity, which I know the best, selective catalytic reduction for NOx was developed abroad under regulation primarily, the technology breakthrough through there. POP and separately Taylor look at the development of FGD for sulfur dioxide removals. And the most important technological innovations there were driven by the NSPS, the New Source Performance Standards. And then after 1990, with a price on SO2, a different kind of innovation took place, where there was these scrubbers improved their removal efficiency, because at that point then it was recognized that a ton avoided was an allowance earned. So their removal efficiency would go from 95% up to, which maybe satisfied the rule, 92 to 95%, up to 98% to squeeze out that little bit of additional efficiency. But the point is that it was really it's a nuance about the kind of innovation that occurred. And then my own work in this area has been looking at the innovation that specifically can be attributed to the cap and trade program. And I found a lot of it. Here you would say this is a price-driven innovation, but it was, in a way, almost an institution-driven innovation, because through interviews with plant managers, we found that, you know, really the engineers and the plant managers were looking inward. For the first time, they had an incentive to look. That, you know, and when they did, then they found opportunities to achieve incremental reductions in SO2 through a variety of non-patentable discoveries that were replicated at 100 different plants in similar ways, and experiences with fuel blending to squeeze out a few tons here and there, etc. So there were a lot of non-patentable discoveries, but not the major technological breakthrough that one thinks of, that one might be hoping for, as a result of the experience of the SO2 trading program. So which ignites innovation more? The answer that the jury is definitely out on that, because we haven't tried prices as much as an economist would like. But it is you cannot deny that regulation drives a lot of innovation. Okay, so now how does institutional context matter? Well, I think it matters entirely. It matters, for example, in any application of any kind of tax or cap or any other rule that you can think of. And there's several ways that have been identified in the literature. Some people, like Hepburn, writes that there's a multitude of market failures. So if you try to address just one of them with a price, you're not going to address the other ones. And if you can try to find prices on all the market, fix all the market failures, maybe that's great, but maybe regulation's going to get there faster. There's a sets of laws and rules and organizations that pre-exist, and a logic of collective action, where there's a large literature that talks about, you know, self serving decisions even after you get price-based approaches in with some momentum. Joskow and Schmalenzi wrote about this with respect to the rules about implementation of the SO2 trading program, and it's occurred writ large in the EU ETS with the development of national allocation plans in the member states. My favorite quote in this regard is Dunlop, who was Secretary of Labor some, I don't know, 40 or 50 years ago, but there's a great quote from him where he says, well, he learned from negotiation that there's actually three negotiations that always occurs. The negotiation over the table and the negotiation on each side of the table. So there's negotiations occurring with different interested parties that are before the regulations can actually take a place. There's a lot of inertia that has to be taken into account, and multiple layers of government. This one is of keen interest if you think about how technologies are going to penetrate in the electricity sector. For example, the role of public utilities commissions was really important in the implementation of the SO2 cap and trade program. The next thing I'm going to hasten through, because I think I'm going on a bit long, but I want to mention infrastructure and coordination, as it relates to the electricity sector and the question of how innovation can be achieved. A price signal may Well, I think what we've observed so far is that there's a price signal and incentives created by renewable portfolio programs, et cetera, have gotten us through sort of the first generation of a technological revolution, the first part of a technological revolution, and identified, if you think back to what people in this room would have been saying 12 years ago or 20 years ago about the prospects for using renewables in the electricity sector, it's really like, wow. And we once did a study where we looked at 60 studies of what were the forecasts for renewables in terms of their costs, accomplishments, and their ability to penetrate the market. And for 5 out of 5 technologies, we found over these, well, about 30 of the studies we threw out because, you know, they were like pamphlets, really. But the other ones that were, you know, thought out, had discount rates involved and things like this, we found for 5 out of 5 technologies that these technologies over 30 years had uniformly exceeded the cost projections of their optimists, of their proponents. And they had also uniformly failed to meet the penetration that was expected by the proponents. And the reason is because the world did not stand still. You know, there was improvements in fossil steam technology, and there was changing relative fuel prices. But technology has been able to achieve generally over the last few decades what the technological proponents have claimed is possible. That's our conclusion from this. And I think we see that now with, you know, the really important contribution that renewables are making, intermittent renewables are making to the electricity system. And this raises the second big challenge, which is the challenge of infrastructure and coordination. And we would not have gotten to fully understanding the significance and magnitude of this challenge if we hadn't already accomplished the first part. I don't think anyone could see that far down the road to ask the question from 1980, well, what's going to happen if we were to get 40% renewables? How would that exactly work? But now we're getting to the point where that's the question on the agenda. And I think one of the most important technological questions that rather than just looking at lab bench technologies that might do something that is already being done but being done in a more efficient way, it's really moving to the question of organizational infrastructure and coordination. And these pose huge challenges for the electricity sector business model. We've got. They see, you know, the so-called death spiral of changing demand. I mean, you kind of ask yourselves, if I can be informal, I'll say, you know, a lot of good faith conversations with electric utility folks in the last 6 or 7 years and with EPRI and everything, which really put a lot of hard thinking going into to energy efficiency, recognizing that there are really opportunities there. But you got to ask yourself, you know, jokingly, what were they thinking? Of course, if this energy efficiency thing finally got traction, it was going to reduce sales and it's going to have an implication for their revenues in the long run. Well, this is the situation that's now posing the new challenges, and the winners in the electricity sector are going to be the ones to figure out how to solve that challenge. So you've got changing demand, changing relative importance of energy and capacity markets is going to be really important, I believe, because you not only have natural gas, which is the marginal price pulling down more marginal revenues, but increasingly with non-emitting sources, no fuel costs at all. So there's, in terms of the total cost basis, it's more and more of it is capacity related, less and less of it is energy related. There's environmental constraints, and then the big question of intermittency. And so this poses huge challenges for infrastructure and coordination, which I think is really the current front question with respect to innovation in the electricity sector. So to conclude, my view in sum, if it isn't apparent what I've said so far, is that prices are crucial in the long run. They're absolutely crucial. But in the short run, I think we'll see that regulators can identify the low-hanging fruit. I think under the Clean Air Act between now and 2020, I'm kind of our work suggests that there's really a lot that can be done if regulations are promulgated for existing sources. By 2020, I think we all might be surprised. But in the long run, you need risk takers to be identifying those options. So they're sort of the ones that are further up in the tree. They're not the low-hanging fruit. In this case, we need markets involved and we need prices. Most economic analysis that come to this question assume sweeping away of existing regulations. They talk about them in graduate economics classes, demonstrate their inefficiency, and erase the board and put up two axes and start showing where the optimum is. The big question in our era, I feel, is how we infuse incentives into regulation, because I view these regulations as sort of the watch, the existing infrastructure, and that, by that I mean so institutions like the Clean Air Act, as the watchtowers of social precedent. They are these institutions are in place for a reason. They slowly change for a reason, and they're not going to be erased off the board. So the way to really make progress in terms of efficiency and innovation, I think, is find ways to infuse incentives into these existing regulations, things like tradable performance standards under the Clean Air Act, I hope, in the course of this decade. And then ultimately, this should lead, I hope, to expanding and making a central role for prices, which ultimately is going to be essentially important for allocational efficiency. So that's my take on the issues.